A massive fire in London, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Flames engulf a 24-story apartment building in London.
People were screaming because they didn't, like, couldn't get their families out, and you could hear people yelling from the top, "Get help, get my children out," and it's just nothing you can do.
Plus, the Saudi woman who dared to drive.
They took the Friday sermons and they called me things like a prostitute. Just driving a car.
It didn't stop her, though. And in Yemen, people are finding it hard to find food to break their Ramadan fast.
People were searching in the garbage to get food. Food that was, to a certain extent, available in the city. But the prices were so high that people could not afford it.
Those stories are all ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're covering a lot of stories today, including that massive high-rise fire in London. More on that in a moment, but first...
My colleagues, there are very strong emotions throughout this House today.
Speaker Paul Ryan addressing the House of Representatives today. He was referring to this morning's shooting in Alexandria, Virginia, which left Congressman Steve Scalise and four others wounded. We're following this story as it develops, and for the latest, head over to PRI.org. Back to the tragedy in London now. At least 12 people are confirmed dead after a blaze tore through a 24-story building in West London, and police expect the death toll to rise. Hundreds of people lived in the building. It had 120 apartments. Earlier, The World's Leo Hornack went to the scene to find out what happened.
Well, Carol, I mean, the story's kind of still emerging, but what's come really clear is just how fast this happened. The fire department, as we say here, got a call just before 1 a.m. our time. By that time, it seems like the blaze was already well underway. I mean, the second thing is just the intensity, Carol, because I'm just a few streets away right now, and I'm looking at the remains of the tower. And it is completely blackened. There's still smoke coming out of it. I mean, and this is getting on for 12 hours after, more than 12 hours after the blaze started. And there's still smoke rising from the building. And so that just gives you a sense of just how intense and how rapidly this fire spread throughout the whole building.
And it sounds like there's people near you at the scene dealing with it there. What is the atmosphere like? I mean, you're right by this building. What are people feeling there now?
Well, I'm a few streets away from the building, but it's such a tall building, Carol, that it kind of dominates the whole area. The mood really round here when you speak to people is obviously of shock. I mean, this happened only this morning. It's just mid-afternoon for us. And, you know, even in that time, just as I was walking here, I saw signs posted, you know, on walls saying things like "come to this place or that place for food and shelter if you were affected by the fire." So there's a whole community that's mobilizing to try and help the residents, and, you know, particularly families who've lost loved ones, of course. But as you can imagine, the impact on people in this area is huge, because this is quite a quiet neighborhood in many ways. One of the residents of the tower, Tamara, spoke to my other colleagues at the BBC about what she saw when the fire first took hold.
And there's people like throwing their kids out, "just save my children, just save my children." And like the fire brigade, the ambulance and the police, they couldn't do nothing. They couldn't get in. They're just telling them to just stay there where they are. "We'll come and get you." And there's still people like at their windows, "help me, help me, help me." And you can see the fire going into the house and into the last room that they're in, and just engulfing their whole apartment.
Oh, it's just horrifying hearing about that. And I understand that Grenfell Tower is what we would call public housing here. I mean, what kind of area is the Grenfell Tower in?
This is an area where London's extremes of inequality are kind of at their most visible. And I think that's what's underlying a lot of the controversy about this fire already. As you say, it's an area, it's what we would call a council estate, what's called public housing in the States. But just a few minutes walk from here, you can see some of the most expensive properties in London. Restaurants, designer clothes boutiques, places where you could spend more on clothes or cars or a house than most people could earn in a lifetime. That inequality is something that a lot of the residents and the people who live around here feel every day of their life. And so when a tragedy like this happens, it really does pull that disparity really tightly into focus, that there's two kinds of London living in an area like this, and they live very, very different lives.
The world's Leo Hornack in London, just down the street from the Grenfell Tower. Thanks, Leo.
Thank you, Carol.
Grenfell Tower was a typical 1970s concrete high-rise block, but it went through some renovations in recent years. The layout was made denser, and the building was wrapped in aluminum cladding. That may have helped spread the fire. Eddie Heathcote is the architecture critic for the Financial Times.
These blocks weren't built to very high environmental standards, so they were drafty as the building moved over the years and the components slightly rotted away around the windows. They would have been poorly insulated. So it was partly to address the practicalities of everyday life inside the buildings, but also partly it was a kind of beautification. Although this is a municipal social housing, it's a project, housing project, it's surrounded by some of the most expensive real estate in the world. And there have been suggestions that actually it was beautified, if we could call it that, so that it was less of an eyesore to the surrounding multi-million pound houses.
Now, a lot of people are thinking that aluminum cladding may have been a factor in this awful fire. Why would it be an issue?
It sounds counterintuitive, but the aluminum composite cladding panels are really only a very, very thin sheet of aluminum foil on the outside. That's mounted on a cladding panel, and the cladding panel is mounted on the outside of the wall. But there's usually a gap between the wall of the existing building and the cladding panel. And that cavity is the problem quite often in these cases. It allows fire to rise in between the wall and this new skin in the cavity between them and rise almost uninterrupted up the tower. And the problem is the residents and the firemen can't see those flames rising.
Now, I know cladding is not the only issue that could have led to this fire. What else was problematic in this building?
There doesn't seem to have been a sprinkler system installed. The alarms didn't seem to be working. The fire alarms didn't seem to be working in the communal areas. And looking at the plans as they've been redone, it seems that the rebuilding squeezed a lot more apartments into the same plan than the old building. And that led, it looks like, as if that led to a kind of reduction in some of the safety features, some of the fire lobbies and so on that you would expect that act as barriers for the fire, between the fire in the stairwells or in the public areas and in the apartments themselves.
I read somewhere that there is only one stairwell in this entire building. Is that true?
That is true, and it sounds remarkable. So if there's a fire in the stairs, there is really no way out. And of course, the firemen's ladders, the firefighters' ladders only go six stories or so.
Are you concerned that we might be seeing more of these kind of fires? I mean, given the way buildings are redesigned and all the other things we've talked about.
Well, I think certainly there is a concern about that. There are thousands still, something like 4,000 of these blocks, social housing blocks, still in the UK. And a lot of them now are of the age when they're needing to be refurbished in some way.
As an architecture critic, is there anything else about this incident that has you completely puzzled?
There is a worry about the way a lot of these buildings are being refurbished, partly for safety reasons, partly for social reasons. A lot of these housing projects in the UK are being gentrified, effectively. And this, I think you could argue, this aesthetic cladding is a kind of response to gentrification. And what's happening is there's a kind of social cleansing program. A lot of social housing tenants are being put out, guaranteed apartments elsewhere, and actually not being allowed to return back to their communities when the buildings are finished. So I think there is a safety issue, certainly, which is obviously at the forefront of our minds now. But there's also a social issue that this is where the city's social accommodation was. Now, as these units are being sold off to the private sector, how are they being replaced?
Eddie Heathcote is the architecture critic for the Financial Times. Ramadan is the Muslim month of fasting. That means no food from dawn to dusk. People in Yemen are now observing Ramadan with 15 hours of fasting every day. But in Yemen, a country that's in the middle of a civil war, two-thirds of the people have been going without enough food. And one incident 9 months ago sent millions of middle-class Yemenis into the ranks of the poor. The World's Stephen Snyder follows events in Yemen for the program. Stephen, how did it get so bad?
Well, late last summer, Yemen's central bank was almost broke. And, well, a lot of factors caused that, but most of them have to do with Yemen's civil war. And starting in September and in October last year, the government stopped paying its civil servants.
And is that a big deal?
Yeah. Estimates range from 250,000 to over a million people suddenly thrown out of work. Their dependents, 6 million people, went from being middle class to being poor. That all happened in the space of a couple of months. This is Abir Itaifa. She's a spokesperson for the World Food Program, the main supplier of humanitarian food aid in Yemen.
These were government employees, you know, college graduates who used to receive a salary from the government are no longer able to receive that. And in addition, there are no more jobs in the private sector that would absorb any of these people.
You can imagine what that means for the families of those government employees. I spoke to Robert Mardini of the International Committee for the Red Cross, and he shared this story from the Yemeni city of Taiz.
People were searching in the garbage to get food, food that was, to a certain extent, available in the city, but the prices were so high that people could not afford it.
So what can humanitarian groups do in this situation?
Well, there is food aid being shipped from the outside by groups like the World Food Program. But because of the war, that aid has to get past a military blockade and through sometimes hundreds of military checkpoints. So it's slow and it's dangerous, and there is not nearly enough funding. And as a result, the World Food Program spokesperson said food is not pouring into Yemen.
For many a month, we have been not able to get food to the families that need help. So out of the 17 million people, we're only assisting 3 million people. And even with these 3 million people, we're providing them with one-third of the food ration.
Now, the World Food Program, Oxfam, CARE, the International Committee for the Red Cross, they all have people on the ground trying to help Yemenis who are close to starvation. And some local NGOs are also doing that. This next voice belongs to a Yemeni man, Fatik El-Rodani. He told me about doing site surveys to figure out if people qualify for aid.
I have visited a family with 19 members. They have nothing in their house. There is no furniture or beds or anything. They don't have clothes for their children. We provided them some blankets, but the blankets we provide them are not big comparing with their need.
It sounds unbelievable. I mean, is it just food that people need?
Well, no. Sometimes what they really could use is money. Another aid worker, her name is Suha El-Ajamad. She shared this example with me.
Last week, we visited a household with 5 children and a pregnant wife. He said he's a teacher, but he didn't receive any salary through the last 8 months, so he couldn't pay any rent since then. The house owner gave them a notice that they need to leave the house if they didn't pay the accumulated rent. The wife mentioned that the last thing they had was her wedding ring, and they sold it for food.
It's just an unbelievable situation.
Well, it is. But the people that I talk with, they're so dedicated and they are working so hard to help the community. And everybody there is very resilient. I even learned of a small nonprofit group that's giving out goats to the poor for the end of Ramadan. So it's grim, but also there are a lot of examples of people helping each other in the middle of a civil war.
The world's one-man Yemen desk, Stephen Snyder. He's got a story with a lot more detail about the famine in Yemen right now, including a picture of one of the goats he just mentioned. Check that out at PRI.org. Driving while female in Saudi Arabia. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where women still can't drive. Clerics in the kingdom have argued that getting behind the wheel might damage women's ovaries. I'm not kidding. Saudi Manal al-Sharif is one of the loudest voices calling for that policy to change. In 2011, she made history by filming herself driving. She posted the video on YouTube. Within a day, her act of defiance was viewed 700,000 times. Today, al-Sharif is still an outspoken advocate for women's rights, but she wasn't always one. In her new memoir, Daring to Drive, she describes growing up in Mecca as a firm believer in conservative Islam. She says she was intolerant of many things, including her family's musical tastes.
Mom and Dad had some classical music, and my brother had the Western music. I made sure to burn all of them. Every time he buys a new tape, I would record on his tape so he would listen to sermons instead of listening to his music. I'm sorry, my brother, for doing this to you. We were taught that this is the right way to enforce Islam, and this is the way to save our families from hellfire. So we were indoctrinated to listen to these sermons and this preaching that put us in that position.
What did you look like back then? How did you dress?
I was fully covered top to toe in black. And that is mandatory from the middle school up to the college. And if you work in any public office, you have to be fully covered in black. So it's, even if you don't want to cover, it's mandatory by law that you have to cover fully. And it's a huge thing if you don't cover your face in my city, Mecca, growing up. Things are changing now. More and more girls are uncovering their face, but they're facing with harsh criticism from the society.
When you turned 18, things began to change. You enrolled in King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah. What happened then?
So Jeddah, although it's only 80 kilometers away from Mecca, it's more liberal. So you find girls there uncover their face. You find girls there have the courage to wear colorful headscarves. And that was huge for me. That was the start of questioning my beliefs, my belief system.
And it was this particular Saudi notion of male guardianship that really began to grate on you. What's the idea behind guardianship?
It's the source of all evil in my country. A woman is considered minor from the time she's born until the time she dies. I'll give you just a simple example. To leave, to get my passport and leave Saudi Arabia, I'm 38 years old. I needed to go to my father. So I get my passport and I get permission to leave the country. So it's really enslaving women. You need permission to do anything in your life from your assigned legal guardian, who could be your father. And if you get married, it moves to your husband. And if you lose your husband and you don't have a brother, it could be even your own son. What we really hope for is to name an age where I become an adult. Until today, there is no official age for me as a woman when I'm considered adult, legally adult. We don't have this.
As you've outlined, there are lots of limits on what Saudi women can do. But restrictions on driving a car is the issue you decided to act on. Why?
I believe the key to change in my country is driving. Nothing emancipates women more than driving. For me, driving gives women sense of independence. She doesn't need a man to move her around. She can apply for jobs because now she can go and drive to her job. While she cannot do that, she cannot afford paying for transportation. We don't have public transportation in Saudi Arabia. We don't have pedestrian cities. And putting a woman waiting for a man to move her around, that's really, it's like cutting her hands and her feet and taking away her wheelchair. You say, you throw them in the sea and you say, you have to swim now. I do believe when women drive in my country, they will have the voice and the power and the belief that they can do anything, and they will act upon ending the guardianship system.
Now, you really took action on this. In 2011, on your 32nd birthday, you decided to drive your brother's car, and you posted a video of yourself behind the wheel on YouTube. Got a huge response, and you were taken to jail. What was the reaction inside the country when that happened?
So the first time I drove, it was my own car. The second time, it was with my brother to prove that there are men supporting women driving. It was trending in Saudi Arabia around the world, my video driving. It got around 700,000 views in like one single day. I received massive number of phone calls, emails, and of course, very offensive comments threatening me to be raped, to be killed, to be beaten if I ever think again to drive. But the worst backlash was really from the religious establishment. They took the Friday sermons and they called me things like a prostitute for just driving a car. That was really the worst part.
And how long were you in jail?
I was in jail for 9 days. So I was sent without a warrant, without a trial, without anything. And that means you could spend your life there. They took me around 2 a.m. from my home. My father had to go to meet the king himself and ask for pardon for me for driving a car.
You know, the driving issue in Saudi Arabia has been an on-again, off-again thing. What's the status of the campaign at this point to abolish restrictions on Saudi women drivers?
So our group name is My Right to Dignity. And we have so many campaigns, but one of the major ones is the Woman to Drive. And the other one, I Am My Own Guardian. But Woman to Drive has been going on for the last 6 years. It's the thing, the only campaign that did not stop and will continue until they issue the first driver license to a Saudi woman. By the way, the driving is still continuing. There was the October 26th move. A lot of women went out and drove. There was Lujain al-Hadloul, who drove from UAE all the way to Saudi. She was stopped at the borders. She was sent to jail for 73 days and banned from leaving the country for a year. And her car was confiscated. So there are a lot of brave actions happening after the 2011. More and more girls posting videos of them driving. More and more men are joining us, supporting women driving. The status is we'll continue campaigning using all the tools that we can. I think, and I believe my book, when it comes in Arabic, it will create a big impact on the Saudi women, and they will have more and more women speaking up, going out and driving their cars. And that will end the guardianship system in my country. And we will be considered full citizens.
Now, Manal, you no longer live in Saudi Arabia. At least you're not there for the moment. When did you leave and why did you leave?
I'm flying back to Saudi after the book tour. This is first. So I do go back to Saudi Arabia. I left in 2012. I was really harassed at work and I was harassed outside. Even my family were harassed. And I had to quit my job to be able to speak up, to be able to do interviews like the one I'm doing with you now. And it was difficult at that time to really stay in Saudi Arabia. I had a work colleague with me who proposed to me and he said, let's get married. But when we got married, we moved to the closest country, which is Dubai, hoping that they give us the approval. Until this day, they're not giving us the approval. Once I get that approval, I'm going back to my country.
Manal al-Sharif's new book is called Daring to Drive, A Saudi Woman's Awakening. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And coming up tomorrow on the show, Teju Cole's new book, Rethinks Global Travel.
In part, it's about how places are really much more deeply connected to each other than we might first think. If we think about a place like Lagos and compare it to a place like Zurich, we think there must be polar opposites in every respect. But that's not the case.
That's coming up tomorrow. I'm Carol Hills. Phones, tablets, laptops, documents, emails, spreadsheets. Trust me, you're leaving an electronic trail behind you.
There is a lot of metadata, data that just drips off of us as we interact with things.
How to cover your digital tracks. That story plus an Iraqi turns letters into music. Ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It seems there's very little everyone in Congress can agree on these days. Well, today they agreed on this. Russia should be punished with new sanctions for meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The Senate today approved a bipartisan plan to do that. The bill still needs to go through a few more congressional hoops, but if approved, it would keep some Obama-era sanctions against Russia in place and impose new ones.
These sanctions will target Russia's shipping industry, railway industry, metallurgical industry, and the sanctions would also shorten the period of time during which Russian companies would be able to obtain loans from U.S. banks.
That's Simon Sarajan. He heads the Russia Matters Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. I asked him how the new sanctions might affect Russia's key industries.
Judging from the previous rounds of sanctions, what happened was that the U.S. government imposed strict restrictions on imports of any U.S. equipment or technology by particular industries of Russia. For instance, the U.S. prohibited exports of dual-use technologies and arms equipment that could have been used by the Russian defense industry. I would imagine that the railway industry and the shipping industry of Russia would see this a similar kind of bans on importing U.S. Equipment and technologies.
How do you think Vladimir Putin is going to respond to these new sanctions?
I think he's going to, as in the past, whenever U.S. does something that Russia doesn't like, Russia picks things to do that U.S. wouldn't like, and that would not be necessarily reciprocal. So I don't expect the Russian government to sanction the U.S. shipping industry or railway industry or metallurgic industry, but he's going to try to find niches and sectors the impact on which would be comparable. So to give you an example, one of the responses by Russia to U.S. sanctions was to ban imports of Western food. And that measure, in a sense, fostered the growth of Russian agricultural industry, okay, because it was essentially a protectionist policy. So you could expect something like that. And if you look closely at measures that the U.S. Senate is pushing for, again, you could argue that the U.S. metallurgical industry would benefit from these sanctions, okay, because Russian metallurgical industry would become less competitive compared to the U.S. metallurgical industry. So that kind of arrangement in which you try to hurt the opposite side most by limiting the damage, the fallout, if you will, from your own sanctions on your own economies would be Russia's response.
I'm wondering what impact the Obama-era sanctions have had on Russia. They've been in place for several years now. Has that been tough?
Well, estimates vary. For instance, former finance minister Alexei Kudrin, who is a widely respected economist in Russia, estimated in 2015 that sanctions were costing Russia 1.5% of its GDP, which would range anywhere between $35 billion to $60 billion a year. That's a tangible loss for Russia, but it's not a mortal blow. So Russia coped with the sanctions, and yes, Russian economy was hurt. Russians felt the pain from sanctions, but it didn't change the overall policy of Russia.
Simon Sarajan heads the Russia Matters Project at Harvard's Kennedy School. Remember when President Trump announced he was pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement? And French President Emmanuel Macron responded with this message to American scientists and engineers?
I want to say that they will find in France a second homeland. I call on them, come and work here with us.
Macron's message seemed like a bold move to recruit U.S. talent and position Europe as a leader in climate policy. But it also echoed an American strategy from a quarter century ago. In the waning years of the Soviet Union, the U.S. began recruiting Soviet experts for jobs in nuclear physics, mathematics, and defense. The World's Daniel Gross recently visited Maryland to meet one of them.
Andrei Afanasyev always tried to keep physics separate from politics. He says he followed physics the way a donkey follows hay. He didn't care where he went, as long as he got a steady diet of science. Luckily, his dad was a scientist and took him to picnics.
Picnics with physicists. They were talking about everything that was interesting to them, so it was like a different world.
Once, his dad brought home some accelerator shielding. Afanasyev used it to cook chicken. But science wasn't always fun. He grew up in Ukraine, back when it was part of the Soviet Union. While Afanasyev was a university student, towards the end of the Cold War, the Soviet nuclear power plant at Chernobyl exploded. It was only a few hundred miles away. His dad's dosimeter, an instrument that measures radiation, was suddenly in high demand.
So we had all these neighbors coming in and asking him to check them for radiation levels.
In the Soviet era, scientists had status. Even though Afanasyev didn't work on nuclear weapons, he had a stable job and special access to rations. But the stability started to slip away when the Berlin Wall fell. The Soviet Union dissolved, and Afanasyev's monthly salary only amounted to $30 in the new economy.
Borders became open. Then you realize how miserable you are.
The United States capitalized on post-Soviet misery. American scientists visited former Soviet laboratories with a message. If your country doesn't have jobs for you, come work with us.
The scientists all fled to the West. Not all of them, but maybe 80%.
One day, American scientists visited Afanasyev's lab in Ukraine. they invited him to work as a visiting scientist at a $500 million government laboratory called Jefferson Labs.
So my wife and my daughter came with a little suitcase for this 3 months. And so we stayed another 3 months and then said, okay, here's a 6 month extension. Okay. And it ended up to be 17 years.
Sometimes Afanasyev missed his home country of Ukraine. Before his father passed away, the two men used to talk about physics on the phone.
Typical conversation, hi, how is mom, how is sister, what's going on? Then we said, okay, so what's new in this form factor measurement? And he was always asking questions. I'm always trying to find an answer.
You must miss that, being able to call him up and ask him, or sort of toss ideas at him.
After he passed away, I've been talking to him for about 3 years, I think, in my head.
Still, homesickness or not, Afanasyev's priority was to follow the science. In the U.S., he looked for new ways to apply particle physics. He worked on defense projects and tried to improve the safety of nuclear power plants. Today, he's a professor at George Washington University. This year, Afanasyev plans to convert his green card into U.S. citizenship. One reason is that his sons are American teenagers. He's also working for defense projects that require security clearance. He still hasn't managed to separate politics and physics. When Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine in 2014, U.S.-Russia relations became icy once again. Russian scientists were no longer allowed in American government labs unless they'd been here long enough to get American citizenship.
When you come to the cafeteria, there is a lot of Russian speech in the cafeteria, but people who are speaking Russian are actually American citizens now.
Growing up, Afanasyev never paid much attention to nationality. He viewed Ukrainians and Russians as one and the same. But now there's a big difference. And whenever violence breaks out between the two countries, it feels personal.
That's a disaster. This shouldn't happen. And somebody failed there, and I cannot point the finger who failed. Maybe it's my fault also because I left my country.
Do you feel that as a scientist pursuing scientific opportunity, you were a part of that problem? That surprises me a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, if you're a citizen of your country and you care what is going on there, you should be there and help to solve the problem.
Afanasyev isn't planning to move back to his country of birth, but he's trying to build a bridge between the U.S. and Ukraine. He wants to recruit a new generation of Ukrainian scientists to work here, and he hopes that both countries can benefit. For The World, Daniel Gross, Gaithersburg, Maryland.
In Iraq, the battle for Mosul continues. Fighting there has been going on for months between U.S.-backed Iraqi forces and ISIS fighters. The militants are losing their grip on the city, but the battle is definitely not over yet. And besides, the legacy of the so-called Islamic State may be felt for a long time in the region. The World's Richard Hall traveled to the Christian town of Karakush, just 20 miles east of Mosul, to find out whether different ethnic and religious groups targeted by ISIS are rebuilding or not.
So as we drive through Karakush now, we can see that lots of the houses have been burned by ISIS before they left. There are scorch marks out of every window.
But it's not just buildings that were destroyed. Ties between Christians and Muslims in the area were too.
Our relationship was good. There is friendship and history between us. But sadly, they betrayed us. They took everything. Terrorism turns even your neighbors against you.
That's Hazem Abush. His family was the first to return to Karakush after it was liberated in December. When I meet him at his house, he apologizes for it being so bare. Like many others, it was looted during the ISIS occupation of the town. He says the carnage here was caused not only by ISIS, but by his Sunni Muslim neighbors who live in the villages surrounding the town. Tens of thousands of Christians who lived in the area fled as ISIS advanced, but many Sunnis in those villages stayed behind, figuring they would have less to fear from the Sunni fundamentalist group.
We came back and found everything stolen. You can't know, they took everything. I have lots of missing stuff from my house. I had a new tractor that was stolen. Someone even took my front door. They sold the area. They burned the area.
Abush's main business was chicken farming. He brings out a photograph of himself standing proudly in the middle of a giant warehouse surrounded by tiny chicks. He says they are all gone now.
So I'm getting into a car with Mr. Abush and a couple of soldiers, and we're going to see his chicken farm to see the damage there. Going into the chicken farm now, and it's completely destroyed inside. There's bullet holes in the wall. There's big mounds of earth everywhere, and what appears to be the inside of a tunnel.
There was a lot of chickens here, but they took them. There was 15,000 chickens here. There was heaters. You can see the traces on the walls. But they took everything. We cannot do anything here anymore.
How does it feel to come back here and see all this completely destroyed, all your work destroyed?
How do I feel? It's hard. I can't pick myself up.
Abush keeps saying it was our neighbors who did this. He lumps ISIS and his Sunni neighbors into one. Who is ISIS made up of? He asks. For him, Sunnis supported the Sunni militant group at the expense of everyone else. After talking with him, I drive down the road to one of the Sunni villages to meet with one of those neighbors he speaks of so disparagingly. In the village of Tawajnat, the first person I meet is Talal Hassan, a Sunni sheikh and tribal leader. He lives on a small farm plot. I ask him, is it true that Sunnis in these areas welcomed ISIS when they first arrived? He says, yes, all the Sunnis did when they first came. The way Hassan tells it, before the Islamic State came along, Sunnis were being oppressed by the Shia-led government in Baghdad. He says the government ruled with an iron fist. Sunnis were not allowed to buy land in certain areas. They were arrested without charge. Many disappeared. It was this oppression that laid the groundwork for ISIS.
When they first came, we thought they were tribal revolutionaries, Sunnis that were being oppressed by the Shias and the Kurds and the US troops that invaded the country. They came to remove the oppression from us. People welcomed them.
But that didn't last long, he says. And soon, everyone became a victim of ISIS.
The killings, the money thefts, no work, taking women. Life stopped completely. People turned against them, but there was nothing they could do.
Like his Christian neighbor, Abush, Hassan was a wealthy man before ISIS came along. He had a few businesses, cars, and made a good living. And like Abush, he too has lost everything due to ISIS. He says he helped Christian families escape, and because of that, he now gets death threats from ISIS. Not only that, he says he fears revenge attacks from people angry at Sunnis for the crimes of ISIS. I asked him what he would say to his Christian neighbours down the road, like Abush, who don't trust him and others like him.
We say that the Christians are our brothers. If you can prove that any of us took your money or attacked you, we are ready to pay you four times. Remember, you lived hundreds of years with the Arab Sunnis.
The story of Karakosh is symbolic of the tests Iraq faces as the threat of ISIS subsides. Abush and Hassan are rebuilding their lives. But can they, and others like them, rebuild the relationship between their two communities? Karakosh is currently without water, electricity, or people. But Abush is confident the Christians will come home, even if they do not trust their neighbors.
They are all coming back. Even the ones calling us from abroad, like Australia and other countries. They said, as soon as services are back, we will all come back.
They will come back, he says, because there is absolutely nowhere like Iraq. For the World, Richard Hall in Karakosh, northern Iraq.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. Hacking might feel like the biggest threat to our digital privacy, but practically everything we do leaves an invisible trail of metadata. Harla Holmes works on digital security for the Freedom of the Press Foundation.
Metadata is data about data. It describes the transactions between different pieces of digital stuff, whether that's an email, a phone call, etc. I like to tell people to picture it as, you know, what happens when you mail a letter, you put it in an envelope, and the envelope has your address on it, the address of the person you're sending it to. It has a stamp. And then, you know, once it gets to the post office, it's probably stamped again, you know, with the time that they've received it. Another stamp gets placed on it just to prove that the stamp wasn't counterfeit and you paid your postage. And so all of these transactions actually pile up and tell a pretty accurate story about the content that's usually hidden inside the envelope.
Now, as you know, 25-year-old NSA contractor Reality Winner, she was arrested earlier this month for leaking a report about Russian hacking in the 2016 election. And investigators reportedly were able to follow a trail of evidence she left behind. What are the most common ways people are tracked?
There was a lot of metadata that she exposed even without, you know, having to do that deeper forensic fact gathering. She had Googled certain things from a computer that was accessible from her workplace. The fact that she had reached out to people establishing this trail of contact, that actually lends quite a data trail. And it's very, very similar to the way that communication records had been used in order to tease out networks of people who are associated with one another via things like call records. And that can be used for marketing, for investigations, for just about anything, because it's about drawing associations.
If one doesn't want to leave a metadata trail, how do you cover your tracks?
That's a very, very tall order. There is a lot of metadata that just drips off of us as we interact with things. Like right now, I'm holding two phones. And because these two phones are in the same proximity, it actually paints a picture about these two devices and the way that I might use them. But that said, if you want to practice minimizing your data trail, what you might want to do is to compartmentalize as much as possible, using separate devices where you do certain things can go a long way. Another thing that's very, very important is choosing a browser that will respect that you don't want to be tracked as you go from site to site, and turning off certain third-party cookies so you're not contributing to an ad profile.
Does metadata hurt some people more than others?
Absolutely. A lot of research has shown that, you know, the way that you view the internet is often created a certain filter that you don't necessarily get to control that makes a lot of assumptions about things like race, class, gender, sexual orientation, and that actually contributes to how you can access certain services. A clear example had to do with the way that Facebook advertisements were able to filter who actually got to see ads based off of a variety of socioeconomic factors. And the thing about that was that no one actually got to ever select exactly which of these categories they were going to be placed into. Facebook decides for them based off the unseen data that people contribute. Ultimately, a lot of this data and how it gets used is definitely not in our hands.
That's Harlow Holmes, who works on digital security for the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We close today's program with A Letter from Iraq. It's part of Future Folk, a new series we're launching today in partnership with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. We begin with Iraqi musician Rahim Alhaj. He has a new album out called Letters from Iraq. Alhaj lives in New Mexico now, but the songs on his album are inspired by actual letters sent by people in Iraq, like this one.
So this, what we're listening to right now, the piece is called The Running Boy, about this little boy, teenager boy, who is disabled and trying to save his life. He said, in one beautiful day, I decided to have a haircut. So he said, while I'm walking from my home to the main street, I see all these people around in the neighborhood, people playing soccer, and there's elderly people sitting in front of their doors, and I treat them, and I was so happy. And I arrived to a barbershop, and the explosion car bombing nearby of the barber shop, and everybody ran, and I tried to run like them, but I couldn't because my legs couldn't carry me. And soon I hear all this crying and screaming and bullet around me, and he said, finally I reached one corner and there's another explosion happened, and this is it. This minute I felt like this is it, because his leg couldn't, from the fear he has, he couldn't even move anymore. And he said, body parts around me, and I felt so small and so insignificant. When I am feeling that this is it, I'm face to face with death. And somehow he said, this is the corner that saved my life. So he said in his side, in the last line of his letter, he said, but it was a beautiful day. It was a beautiful day. Why this has happened, really? This record is the summit of my career, just because I think here I am, I don't have ego to this record. I feel like I'm obligated as a human being first to tell the story.
Musician Rahim Alhaj and the story behind Running Boy, a song from his album Letters from Iraq. Our story was part of Future Folk, a new collaboration between The World and the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.